I'm Alan Walker, and in this episode I spoke to Head Start CEO Gareth Jones. We talked a little about HR tech, how it's evolved and where it's heading, and a lot about the new normal, the four-day week, and other leadership bollocks. Enjoy!
Please take your seats. This evening's performance is about to begin.
Hi Gareth, welcome to the Chat Talent People podcast.
Hi Alan, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good. As well as can be expected. In cooped up in my flat.
keeping safe, keeping sound, sane even.
Yeah, just about. I'm getting out of my once a day walk in the mornings, but yeah, I'm surviving. I've got my son who's 17 and my daughter who's 20 here, so we're sitting it out together. As you do.
Oh, fair enough. For those that don't know you, I know certainly here in the UK you're probably fairly familiar to anybody who works in the HR tech industry, mm-hmm. probably even the wider talent industry as well. But for those that might not know you, Gareth, could you tell me a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Sure thing, yeah. So, I'm Gareth Jones. I'm currently the CEO of a company called Head Start. Head Start are a early talent candidate matching and management system. We're almost a scale up business. We're 4 years old, so we come from the startup arena, and that's kind of where I spent a number of years working in and around startups, and also in and around the people and people tech industry. I've been in that nearly all of my career, in various shapes and guises. I don't have a very typical career, I guess.
What does that mean then? Where did you start? What was your first ever role in the people space?
My first ever role out of uni was out of Polytechnic, as it was in those days, was as a personnel officer in a global manufacturing company based in Basildon in Essex. And I moved there thinking it sounded quite glamorous, Basildon. This was a long time ago because I am old. And I did 10 years in corporate HR effectively, and left because I was primarily quite disillusioned with the way we treated people in organizations. So this was back in the late 90s, sort of 97, 98. And sort of before the explosion of HR, human resources, and we had it kind of took on a new meaning. But I'd heard a lot of, in my organization, the whole classic, people are our most important asset. We're talking about it now, even, all the things we talk about in HR, we're still talking about 30 years later. And I just found that wasn't true. The higher up the food chain I got, the more I felt that we were paying lip service to that. So I figured I ought to get out of HR, because either the real world doesn't operate like I think it should, and I just need to get with the program and get a proper job. And then I'll realize that I was just, being a fantasist, or I'll discover that, we don't take people seriously, and maybe I can do something about it in a commercial role. And so I left and did a number of various things. I went into executive search for about 18 months. Then I went into technology, working for a company that was setting up recruitment web technology in the time in the late 90s. And I never really looked back. I spent the rest of my career in people and technology and consulting in some shape or form, a couple of times working for myself and startups, and a couple of times working in other businesses. So I've kind of made my way to, I've run a company before. I ran a recruitment business actually for a few years, and I now run this business. So I'm in the commercial role that I kind of aimed to get. And I can honestly say that, we do treat people like crap. And they're not seen as our most important asset. Sorry, I shouldn't say crap. But
swear on it. We've had Fs and all the Bs you can imagine. Nobody's dropped the C bum yet, but no, everything else is
I'll tell you that one. I firmly believe that it is people are your only point of difference. Mr. Dyson is only a man in his shed without everybody around him. At the end of the day. And that's a common story. But once we get beyond a certain point, we just, we take our people for granted, I think. And, we manage them in a very, very archaic way. And I think it's interesting times now. that might
very
be
interesting times
for some change. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, but absolutely.
That's how I got to where I am.
You know, I think you know your background is fascinating, and that you've been there and got the T-shirt from the perspective of having worked in HR, which many CEOs of HR tech companies can't necessarily claim to have done. Mm-hmm. And I know you're not a big fan of the phrase HR tech. It's people tech. Yeah. I will remind myself of that as we go through this conversation. But whatever we call it, you've been a practitioner. You've been there and done that. And then, you know, you've then worked your way through into tech. Not all that long ago in the grand scheme of things, but still probably half of your career, if not more, has been in the tech space, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. From the first startup I got involved in, the first tech business I got involved in was 1998. So what's that? 2008. So 22 years.
I guess that is quite a long time. Yeah. Oh, actually, I'm going to take that back.
I'm getting old, mate. I tell you, I'm too old. So yeah. And those are the early days. Yeah, that was back in the days of CompuServe and AOL and the first, you know, companies that were reaching using the web to actually capture a candidate. And it was the Wild West of tech back then.
Absolutely. You've seen the whole evolution, the revolution, whatever you want to call it, of tech. And I think when we were talking off air before we went live with the recording, we were talking about the fact that, you know, some people have got these systems that claim to do everything. You know, they do 1,000 different things, but they do them all badly. And then you've got the others in the startup space that do 6, 7, or 8 things really, really well. And I think that's what really excites me about our industry. And I think it's what excites you as well, isn't it? They're the really cool places to be playing.
Yeah. I mean, the HR tech space, I think, is still. You know, I hate to say it, HR has generally been the poor cousin function of the enterprise for many years. Yeah. And that's not a slate on HR professionals at all. You know, you get the HR function you want as a business, and that sits with the CEO. Simple as that. The tech that supports that function has been the poor cousin of HR tech for decades. And, you know, there's an interesting parallel. So, you know, if a guy from I can't remember, Kimberly Clark, I think it was the CRM director of, I think a guy from the States, was doing a digital presentation a long time ago now, and sort of the late 2000s or even a bit earlier, I think it was about the late 2000s. And he was talking about the shift in digital to the from when the company had the advantage in technology. So, you know, we all grew up, our first exposure to tech was through the company we worked for, right? So the first PC I got came from the company. The first mobile phone I got kind of came from the company, more or less. The first bit of software that I used, the first exposure to Excel and Microsoft Word, and all came from the company provided it to me. And then over time, the consumer software market developed, right? So, and then if you leap forward a bit, what happened was that the consumer, the individual, you know, had the advantage. Because all of a sudden, the technology that we were using outclassed what was being provided by our large corporate, right? So that created a massive shift. That shift towards, you know, the power of the individual in technology was a significant shift in the development of technology and the development of us as individuals. I think I see a very similar thing with people. So you've got that shift, and that's now that the technology shift is now maturing to something that I would call the consumerization of B2B technology, right? That's where it has to go. And most of the HR technology that exists, you wouldn't consider it to be consumer technology at all. You know, for a long time, I believed that large scale enterprise technology had to be horrible and clunky and awful to use. Because there was a law that said it had to be, that there must be some reason behind the scenes that this technology had to be as bad as it was. And of course, that's the truth is that the old way of buying, selling and buying software was the companies used to create the software. They'd go and sell it to the IT director. The IT director would say, not in this company unless you build me these 1,000 features in it. Those 1,000 features were never taken from the HR team or the team that had been bought for. And then they would buy that software and then they would turn around and say, right, everyone's got to use this platform. And I got involved in when I was still in corporate HR in a big global SAP rollout. And it was a disaster because, you know, the system was chosen and configured for, you know, by people who weren't using it. And that really opened my eyes and why I got really fascinated into technology. So you've seen that shift. And I think that consumerization shift we're into now, this, you know, moving towards, we demand as users better experience. We don't want this clunky, horrible system. We want it to do the 10 top things that I have to do. And so almost the software becomes invisible because it's so good. So you've seen that shift, I think, in tech. And it's exciting times because, you know, we as consumers, I think, we can take that further. And I do believe the enterprise technology of the future won't be necessarily the enterprise players of today. I think
the
consumer has to buy it. We have to see the consumer, the you know, in my case, right, the candidate. Let's take my example. It is an enterprise that buys our technology. But in product development terms, classically in my kind of business, we would then talk to and only really think about the recruiters and the buyers, right? And we would build our technology for them. We are trying to shift that because we really want to actually think about the consumer who's using it, either candidate and this and the recruiter. And we should be designing the software and almost treating them as though they would be paying for it.
Yeah.
Right? It's a subtle difference, but that's how we should be looking. And all round, looking for opportunities and looking for to solve the problem. You know, what is the problem we're trying to solve? So I think there's been a distinct lack of trying to understand the problem. There's a lot of technology out there where it's, I've got a great bit of technology, now let's go and find a problem to solve with it. So that, you know, I think there's a big evolution in technology which still exists in HR. And I'm not surprised that HR has been one of the biggest and most explosive areas in technology, startup technology in recent years.
It's been insane over the last 3 or 4 years. The new products that come onto the market what feel like almost daily. Mm. It's trying to keep on top of it, which I kind of see as my job to a certain extent. It's really, really difficult. Mm. But you start moving away from trying to keep on top of individual bits of technology and actually make sure you're on top of concepts and kind of principles of technology. And I think if you come from a background of tech, that's actually much easier to do. Mm. And you find yourself there when you're going in and actually taking a look at an individual piece of technology, demoing, etc., you can rattle through those a hell of a lot quicker if you come from a tech background initially and you keep your finger on the pulse. But actually trying to claim that you know every bit of HR tech that's out there is just... it's impossible and stupid to try and do, I think. But it's understanding, we always talk to our clients and about the kind of the art of the possible, knowing what can be achieved. You know, it won't be achieved by a single platform necessarily, but what could be achieved by clipping together four or five different solutions into a stack. Yeah. And actually knowing that, you know, by getting all of these things working beautifully together and complementing each other rather than any of them trying to claim to them everything, you get far better results that way than you will if you go out and try and get something off the shelf that says, I can do this, and this ad infinitum forever.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because there is a driver to do that. The classic, you know, the one thing I've kind of learned and over the years is that niche is good. And, you know, do something really, really well. Don't try and do too much. If you do something really, really well, there will always be a market and a need for it. And, but, you know, especially with data and the whole thing around data and data science and insight and analytics in the last sort of 3 years or so, everybody is trying to, there's a turf war. You know, everybody wants more of the food chain in talent technology. Let's take as an example, because they want to own more of the journey so they can own more of the data, so they can own more of the insight. And I think that's not necessarily a good thing, because then you get vendors overlapping and then it becomes really difficult to sit two pieces of technology together. Whereas if they were a little bit more concise, you could build a lovely ecosystem, because it's actually much easier to tie these bits of tech together now than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Of course it is. Or even 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's downside easier. People are building their tech to make it easy because they know that the big enterprises will demand that of them.
Yeah.
But even smaller companies, if it makes their technology more accessible to smaller businesses as well because they know they can hook up with their HRIS or their ATS or whatever it is they use and do it in a relatively straightforward way. Mm. But moving on a little bit specifically from HR tech, but I think we'll probably loop back into this off the back of this next question. We were also talking offline about the likes of Josh Burson talking about the new normal.
Yeah.
You're way smarter than me, Gareth. What does he mean by that? And what does it mean for businesses?
I doubt that, Alan. Would I be doing this if I was smarter than you? I don't know. At my age. I think, you know, what I'm reading into that, and it's just classic, you know, it's classic Josh, and, you know, Josh is a well-respected guy and, you know, a bit of a spokesperson in our industry, but Josh and other consultants, I guess, they're always very quick to take the situation and define a new norm, to define what this means, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's really, it's far too early to define what a new normal is based on less than 12 weeks of a shift, you know, in the situation we're in. And what he's talking about is all of a sudden, there was a second article he did recently as well about leadership and effectively what he's kind of saying is new normal. We're all going to be working from home. And yeah, in times like this, it's a good job that, you know, leaders globally, there's a new leader defined as someone with empathy and, you know, courage and, you know, just is kind and, you know, leads from the back and all of these softer skills in leadership, as though magically 90% of corporate leaders are these, you know, nice guys who can deliver and engage their people. And it's just total bollocks. It's just complete and utter rubbish because, you know, globally we have an engagement problem, right? We talk about it every year and have done for years, almost decades. We have a diversity problem, right, globally. And this is despite report after report after report after report that comes out of McKinsey and all these other companies that says, if you have inclusive hiring and you have a diverse workforce, you will be the top of your game as a company. You will generate more revenue. If you increase engagement by 5%, you'll increase revenue by 55% or something like that. And yet these smart leaders completely ignore it. Because we got just the wrong approach to people. And so what he's talking about is this, you know, this sudden new kind of utopia that's going to emerge from this. And I think there's a couple of things to say about that. One is I think it's really, really interesting that companies have been forced into adopting home working, people working from home. And I do think this could be a bit of a catalyst because when this all washes through, and it will wash through, assuming that some remnants of an economy survive, there are going to be an awful lot of people who were prevented from working from home simply because the company didn't trust them. They would never say that. They would say, oh, it's just a business. We like to be face-to-face and we like to do this. But basically, fundamentally, companies do not trust people. That's why we allow them to work from home one day a week or something else. And that, I think, is going to be questioned. And I think, as individuals, we should question it, right? We have more power now. What the company does and what the company thinks is out on social media very, very quickly now. You know, opinions are out very quickly. And I think it's an opportunity to leverage this and say, listen, why should I start coming back into the office if I don't want to, right? And I think we will see a shift because we've had the technology to do all this for decades. And we really should be leveraging this and making knowledge work a hell of a lot easier to do. Notwithstanding, there are a lot of people who escape home and need to escape home because they're like, and I was talking on a webinar a couple of weeks ago about, you know, mental health, mental illness, and, you know, how we really need to be careful that people, particularly in this environment where you're locked in your house, can be really dreadful. But generally speaking, what he's talking about is this, you know, all of a sudden this defines a new way of working that we'll all be doing straight away almost or very, very soon by 2025. And there's a whole new generation of empathetic leaders and there isn't. And it's just, you know, we've got a long, big oil tanker to turn around when it comes to empathy and treating people like they are your most important asset, which we don't. And
people revert to type quite quickly, don't they, as well?
Yeah.
They're forced to behave in slightly different ways or do things that they're not comfortable with, i.e. people working from home and managing their teams remotely. But as soon as things go back to normal, whenever that is, you know, 6 weeks away, 6 months away, however long it happens to be in whatever country you are in the world listening to this, an awful lot of people will revert to type. Mm. And even with all of the evidence that's presented to them that says, actually, we got through this. We did work quite effectively. In fact, some people in some organisations might have been even more effective.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people where trust is something that you're either a trusting person or you're not to a certain extent. Yeah. And a lot of people just aren't trusting. And a lot of them, unfortunately, a lot of those people are in leadership roles.
Precisely, they are. And, you know, there are people saying, you know, that there are people acknowledging that things are better and we are more productive. There are some people acknowledging that there are, you know, benefits. But there's no more new information, right? We could have done this a year ago or 2 years ago because there were plenty of people who were doing it 2 years ago who said, this is a great idea. And people scoffed at it. And it's like the whole, you know, you mentioned the 4-day working week, which you know, have a real bit of an issue with.
Go on, you're going to have to tell me why.
Because for me, the 4-day week is a bit like Dress Down Friday. It's tokenism. Yeah. It's pointless in a way because, you know, as pointless as Dress Down Friday was, it was a precursor to people who couldn't, face not being in a suit, getting used to it. And so the 4-day week is a bit of an antidote to the way we run corporates. And I think that, and it comes with questions. I'm not knocking it as a direction of travel. And, you know, for somebody who can now work 4 days a week, it's great. But as we saw with Jamie, you know, when he was doing his recruitment, you know, his experimenting with it, it does raise lots of questions. You know, when I hire, am I hiring someone for 4 days or 5 days? If we need to change and up the hours, what do we do? What day of the week? Do we give them a choice? And all those things. Yeah. And actually, we employ grown-ups, right? And that's how we operate. So I hire someone in our business, and it's very simple. You work where you like and when you like.
Yeah,
right?
Good.
We don't care. I have no interest in how you do that, except don't want you to upset the team. Right. That's the key thing. But the mantra is you just need to meet your outcomes. That's all we're interested in. And those outcomes are for yourself. So meet your own personal objectives, because unless you're the best you, you won't deliver to the team. Right.
Yeah.
And if you don't deliver your best you to the team won't deliver the best you to the company. So for me, the foundation is you as an individual have to feel completely empowered and completely healthy, as healthy as you can be, mentally and physically. And to be that, you need autonomy and you need choice. So I don't care if you want to work from Sri Lanka for 3 weeks or, you know, to spend, as one of our engineers did, spent almost two months in Austria skiing for the first 2 months this year and working from there. And some people say, well, how do you know they're working? Well, I don't. I just know that our product gets built. I know that our clients love our team and the people that we're talking about, and that they do a great job. And all of my ambitions and outcomes that I expect to see get met. And, you know, the team, funnily enough, don't spend all day in bed asleep. You know, they don't take the piss. They don't suddenly disappear, you know. In fact, my only mandate...
Because you treat them like adults.
Yeah, treat them like adults. And my only mandate to people is, if you're going on holiday, you can work... If you want to work from Italy, that's fine, but you're working, right? If you want to go on holiday, you're on holiday.
Yeah.
Don't want to hear about it. Don't want to hear from you. You are not working. That's the only mandate. So I think, generally speaking, in that whole arena, we need to get a hell of a lot better. The time is now to start treating people like adults. If you want to get the most of the workforce, particularly in times like this, if we're going to recover from this, we need to start trusting folks.
I'm probably more innovative than I think. So years ago, when I ran a recruitment business, I used to have a similar approach. I was like, look, I don't care whether you're on the moon, Mars, at home, at your mum and dad's house, sat in a cafe somewhere, if you're working and you're happy working there and you're delivering the outcomes or output that the business expects and our customers expect and our candidates expect, I really couldn't give a monkey's whether that's 5 days a month, it's 5 days a month, 5 days a week, 7 days a week, 7 days a month. Actually, yeah. I don't give a shit.
No.
It really doesn't matter. You are a grown-up. You know what your target is. You know how you're rewarded. If you exceed that target, you know how you'll be unrewarded if you fall below it. Yeah. I don't care how many calls you make a day, how many CVs you send, how many candidates you interview. As long as everybody you talk to and engage with is people with that engagement and that interaction, and the end result is you deliver the outcomes that the business needs from you, and I'm happy. And people are like, oh, okay. And then the next day they've come into my office. Oh, Alan, I've got a doctor's appointment tomorrow. Can I, is that okay? I'm like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
How many times? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, just how much time do you end up, do people end up wasting approving doctor's appointments or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah. And, you know, you were ahead of your time, Alan.
I must be, exactly. Yeah. It's much easier when I'm now running a company of two people and we're both co-founders. We both do what the hell we like now. Nobody cares.
There you go.
Oh, Gareth, that was fantastic. Thanks for your time, mate. It's really enjoyed that conversation.
You're welcome.
And I know we had about 40 minutes of pre-podcast chat that we probably should have recorded as well. I think we boiled most of it down into this conversation.
Yeah. No, it's good. I really enjoyed it. It's good to catch up. It's been a while. So, yeah, it's really good.
And you. Thanks. See you soon. Take care.
And you. Cheers. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Head over to chattalent.com for more blogs, vlogs, webinars, and other great content about HR, talent, and recruiting. Everything you could possibly need. Enjoy!